You sit around forever.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Yesterday, we were taking public testimony on Senate Bill 570. We're going to continue with that testimony at this time. And let's see who we've got here. Jeff, why don't you come up, and Karen, and let's see. You had, was it Sean was with, was going to be with you in that last, yesterday as a panel?
Yeah, well, Kevin Campbell's available as well.
Okay. Then Kevin, why don't you come up as well, and we'll go ahead and put four chairs up there.
Okay.
Batteries are falling everywhere. I think we'll be fine. We're going to just kind of go this by gauge, but if you can limit your comments to new material as compared to yesterday, and ditto where whatever else, that would be great. And Jeff, why don't you get us started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm pleased to be here this morning, and I will not repeat the how agriculture was impacted. My growers did that yesterday. But I'm here with really two hats on, not only as the nursery industry, but also the chair of the Metal Theft Coalition that's been meeting over the past 3 years. This is a remarkable coalition, one that involves agriculture, construction, law enforcement, metal recyclers, and the utilities and transportation folks. So all the different issues that you're going to touch in this bill, having around one table arguing over the issues. The 2007 bill was a very good bill. It was a small yet powerful bill, and I think that the metal recyclers deserve a tremendous amount of credit about changing their business practices through that bill. And a lot of the actors you'll hear from are the good guys when it comes to metal recycling. There are issues that we commend you with Senate Bill 570, especially within the Dash 1 amendments. The Metal Theft Coalition has provided you all with our recommendations for this legislative session. I'm pleased to see that many of the elements that the coalition suggested are represented in the Dash 1 amendment, so I thank you for that. A lot of these issues have been vetted, and I won't go into great detail about where we had tremendous angst and argument and consensus. However, I would state that our job, even when my hope is when Senate Bill 570 is passed, that we still have work ahead. This coalition is going to reassemble. It has a broader vision, and my testimony that I provide to you outlines what we think the next steps are. So I thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief, and I'm going to use less than my 3 minutes.
Great.
Chair Fazanti, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm going to be even briefer. But I did participate on behalf of the Chiefs Association and the coalition. Actually, Raul Ramirez, the executive director of the Sheriff's Association, had hoped to be here this morning but was sick, so I'm here in his stead. I just want to mention that the coalition process was a very positive one. It gives a wide range of entities the ability to understand each other's world and help forge solutions that recognize the differences we all have. That being said, we don't all agree on everything. We are supportive of the Dash 1 amendments, and we're supportive of the bill. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the time, and I won't go into any greater detail.
Great. Thank
Do
you
I
very
get
much.
Credit for that or something?
We'll put that on your time for next
Thank
time.
Thank you. All right. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Karen Blythe. I'm with the Construction Industry Crime Prevention Program. We're also a member of the coalition and have been really pleased to be a partner there. I won't go into what Keith and Kevin have already talked about, but I wanted to share with you a little bit that's not codified in the law, but definitely was a result of the coalition, and that's the communication sharing that occurred between recyclers and law enforcement. I've given you some examples of some alerts, but we now have a system implemented whereby law enforcement and victims can send us specific information about metal thefts, and we get that out to all of the scrap metal recyclers in the Northwest, including including recyclers in Washington. So recyclers know specifically what it is that has been stolen, and they know specifically what it is that they should be watching for. So that has been an asset that came out of the Metal Theft Coalition. In addition, we are also facilitating law enforcement recycler meetings throughout the state so that we can have discussions regionally about what metal theft issues are. And those are definitely an added resource that will help stop metal theft. In spite of the implementation of the alert system and in spite of the information sharing meetings, our contractors also found that as metal prices increased, so did reported thefts. Conversely, as the metal prices decreased, the reported thefts decreased. So we think that the Senate Bill 570 and the Dash 1 amendments in conjunction with the communication efforts that we've embarked on will help reduce metal theft in the future for our contractors and for our clients.
All right, great. Thank you. Sean?
Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I will be even briefer yet. I've been with the Oregon Farm Bureau for a little over a year and a half, and in that time, I've met quite a few of the nearly 8,000 farming and ranching families that we represent in Oregon. Anecdotally, usually the conversation always goes to metal theft. There probably isn't a member that I have talked to over the last period of time since I've been with the Bureau that hasn't had some sort of theft ranging between the $2,000 and $5,000 range. I will say that I knew it was a serious problem when I started to get phone calls from farm supply stores who appreciated the business of repeat customers, but after members had picked up some equipment up to three or four times in a row, the farm supply stores started to call the Oregon Farm Bureau and said something has to be done. So with that, I'd just like to conclude my testimony. We support Senate Bill 570 and the Dash 1 amendments and look forward to seeing any other modifications that the committee might make from here on out. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Before you leave, let me see if there's any questions.
I just have a brief one.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Ms. Blythe, in that alert system that you talked about, once the alert, and I was looking at the pictures, thank you, picture does say a lot. Once the alert goes out and the recyclers know about it, do they actually, if they encounter somebody with that material, do they take it in and then try to find the owner, or do they refuse to take it because they know it's probably stolen?
Well, we try and provide enough information on the alert that they can call law enforcement, so we have, typically there'll be a case number on there, so they, many times they'll hold the suspect, not physically hold them, but deter them while they call the police so that the police can respond. So it has been effective in that way that law enforcement has on occasion been able to match up the items and the actual theft. So,
thank you.
On some cases, there is one example in there where this particular recycler purchased the material suspecting that it was stolen, held it aside, sent us a picture and said, could you send this out and see who the owner is? And you'll see on the second alert, the follow-up alert, that right. We were inundated with calls and emails, and within just a few hours we had identified the owner and got their material back.
Thank you.
All right, and I wanted to follow up also on the alert system. After yesterday's public hearing, the Portland police officers or detectives that were here testified, and we're talking about another system that's coming online in another 30 to 45 days. And I didn't get enough information on that. And Kevin, I hate to put you on the spot, but my understanding from what I heard was that this was going to be a system that everyone would be able to get on, as well as I understand how the CICP works. But this one may give a little bit more ability to have information shared between law enforcement directly to the yards. And I'm wondering if you have anything that you could share on the record about that.
Chair Pruzanski and members of the committee, I'm aware of the system but not the details. And if you don't mind, what I would like to do is get right back to you, if I can do that today, with some detail. I realize it's not timely in terms of the committee meeting today, but
Okay. That would be great. And Jeff, maybe you know a little bit more.
Mr. Chair, I can shed a little light on it. The Portland Police Department did come in and make a presentation to the coalition on this. And the only complicating factor is that the sheer number of transactions that occur at a metal yard dwarf what you might see at a pawn shop. So it's the actual inputting of all the information to go live is the problem in terms of labor for the metal recyclers. So I don't think it was a reticence to try to make sure that we catch criminals. I think it's just a purely a manpower issue for the recyclers, but they can speak better that than I.
Okay, my understanding, maybe what I'm hearing is maybe the presentation said that they wanted everything to be put in, but my understanding this might have been a way that the metal recyclers could actually put something out to law enforcement that they thought was suspicious as compared to each item that was being brought in or each transaction. So, but if we can get a little bit more information about that, because it seems like that might be something that we may want to include into the bill. So we can do that. And I actually see City of Portland's representatives here, so David may be able to come up and give us a little bit more. He was with us yesterday. So, all right, with that.
If I could just comment on that.
You may.
The alert system that we're using now through our organization does go to law enforcement agencies, and any law enforcement agency can participate in that. And so the picture, typically we try and get a picture, but the information is timely, and it typically goes out within hours, but always within 24 hours of that we're notified of a theft.
Okay. And the last part, I guess, Karen, I wanted to just clarify. It appears that the CIPC is already establishing or setting up meetings with law enforcement and other industry reps, meaning construction or the metal recyclers.
Well, actually, we're setting up meetings with law enforcement and recyclers so that they can share information.
Okay.
We have had other meetings with, you know, contractors and railroad folks and a lot of those other kinds of meetings. But the impetus recently has just been on recyclers and law enforcement sitting in a room sharing information.
All right. And is this something that the organization is willing to continue to do in the future?
Definitely.
All right.
Definitely.
And the reason I ask, if you look at the Dash Ones, we do talk about maybe having the district attorneys around the state being a facilitator, but we also realize that may not be able to occur based on resources or lack thereof. And so if we have maybe another organization that's willing to do that or assist, will help maybe keep those connections going.
Sure.
So thank you very much. Our next individuals that will be coming forward, Mike, come on up, Tom, and Ted Hughes. And then David, let's see, is David here? He already stepped out.
Mike, do you want to get started?
That'd be great.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. We also, OFIC supports the efforts of the committee, the legislation, and the work that everyone's done on this important topic. We've not been a full-fledged member of the coalition from the beginning, but my work with Mr. Stone on a number of different issues has kind of brought me into that circle. Not to double up, we share the same concerns for the public, the worker safety, and the environmental damage. I think the deputy from Douglas County yesterday mirrored everything that I'd really want to say today. Looking at the bill in Section 1, the subsection 2, they're listing all the different businesses that are affected. I've been working with Mr. Stone there to potentially include forestry and logging operations as potential targets. We are hit hard from our members and also the logging community. And that concludes my thoughts.
Great. Thank you. Ted?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Cemetery industry is also involved in this program, so the dead are not being overlooked in this theft situation. We tried to get a handle on how much fiscal damage has been done. We're not able to do it, but we were able to estimate that the replacement cost for the damage that was done is several hundred thousand dollars. So we, even though we don't know, increased fines and penalties will do it, let's try it anyway and support Senate Bill 570. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Tom.
Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing BNSF Railway. The railroad is very supportive of comprehensive metal theft legislation. Senate Bill 570 is their sort of bill of choice. Metal theft's obviously an issue across the board for a number of industries, as we've heard here. Safety is a major issue for the railroad, as well as, frankly, just the transportation system, being able to move when switches are shut down because wires have been pulled out. It shuts down the whole system for a period of time that creates problems that ripple through the economy.
Great, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you. Gil Meyer and Andrea Meyer.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm listening to the testimony. It's quite compelling to understand there's a need for increased coordination that must occur between law enforcement and the metal recycling industry. On its principle, OCDLA does not oppose Senate Bill 570, but we do have some concerns on procedure, and we have three concerns, and we'd just like to point them out to you. Arise from the original bill. So my first comment would be to Section 4, which is on page 5 of the original bill. It's the process by which law enforcement can acquire records from a metal recycling, a scrap metal business. It states that not later than 2 business days after receiving from the peace officer or law enforcement agency a warrant, a subpoena, or other lawful demand, then the scrap metal business shall provide to the peace officer a copy of the transaction. We have no problem as it relates to the warrant. The warrant would, of course, give the authority for the law enforcement officer to seize or to acquire right then and there the copies of the transactions. But as to a subpoena is a document described by statute. It's a process by which you actually compel something into a courtroom, into a court or into a magistrate. And lawyers get in a pinch if they ever issue a subpoena and then simply grab the documents before they get into the courtroom. So our objection would be that we would hate to see the subpoena statutory framework adjusted here such that an officer can deliver a subpoena and then two days later simply show up and acquire the record. The subpoena is the means by which something is brought before a court or a magistrate or a tribunal. And that would be ORS 136.555. We're also not clear what the phrase any other lawful demand would consist of. We don't know what that means, and we would ask that it be clarified. My second comment would relate to, again, Section 4, but subsection 2 of it. And it's an unusual provision. I don't see this often. Basically, what it does is it obligates a scrap metal business to notify law enforcement if they have good cause to believe that scrap is stolen. And we'd all like to think that our social fabric and network is strong enough that people do voluntarily report to law enforcement, but I can't think of very many instances in which it's mandated a fine that someone must report. The only instance when I can that I know of where that exists right now by statute is with the mandatory reporting of sex abuse for licensed professionals. If a licensed professional in Oregon has reasonable cause or suspicion to believe that a child that they come in contact with has been abused, then we have an obligation to report that. But that is my understanding is the only instance when the legislature has mandated under penalty that someone must report a crime. This would be the only other instance that I'm aware of. And I would simply ask, where ultimately is the end of this process? I mean, where are we going with this demand and what's the end of it? And this would be subject to up to a $1,000 penalty for a violation. And again, we certainly would like to think that all businesses would cooperate with law enforcement, but this would be a very rare instance when I think the legislature would compel it. my last comment would be, again, on the original bill, Section 9, on page 8. It creates a crime. A scrap metal business commits the offense of unlawfully, I'm looking at lines 32 to 38 on page 8. A scrap metal business commits the offense of unlawfully purchasing or receiving metal property if the scrap metal business purchases or receives metal property and reasonably suspects that subsection B, the person is under the influence of intoxicating liquor or a narcotic drug or a controlled substance. I'd submit to the committee that I think that's a very difficult standard for a scrap metal business owner to comply with. Even law enforcement officers need to be specially trained to be drug recognition experts, and not all peace officers really are professionally trained and equipped to make that determination. And I would submit to the committee that it would be improper and almost an impossible standard for someone in the scrap metal industry to comply with that standard. That is a crime, and that is a Class A misdemeanor as otherwise created on subsection 6. So we would urge the committee to simply delete subsection B on lines 37 and 38. Thank you. That concludes my comments.
Thank you.
Chair Pozonski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. I will not repeat but agree with Gail's comments with the concerns that she raised on behalf of OCDLA. I just want to add a few others in addition from the ACLU. Specifically to Section 7 is a section relating to the prosecuting attorney, in that case the attorney general or a DA, having some authority with a level of probable cause to appear to get a restraining order or to have a court find a person in violation of the law who's otherwise not in violation under a criminal penalty provision. It appears to be a civil action. I'm just not clear on that process. I'm not familiar with that scheme, so I'm raising questions and concerns and urging you all to look at that a little bit more carefully and see whether that's the appropriate way to go when you're outside of the criminal sanctions directed at someone. And what standard will be in the court? Is this a criminal proceeding or a civil action? So I appreciate the opportunity for you to look at that section a little bit more. I spoke this morning to someone who represents and works as an advocacy executive director of an advocacy organization in Portland for folks who are homeless. And I think yesterday you heard a little bit of an unintended consequences related to folks who are bringing in small amounts for recycling or purposes who are not, and there's no suggestion that they're bringing in hundreds of dollars engaged in criminal activity. And one part you heard of is the people who are doing the home recycling and also the concerns with folks who don't have checking accounts, and if you're only going to get a check for a small amount, it may create a significant burden on folks who don't have checking accounts. And I want to raise that issue also in the context of folks who are homeless, who are, similar to recycling cans, able to recycle and obtain, some cases it is through dumpster diving, but it's not necessarily stealing, or it's other times it's arrangements with businesses to take those small amounts and, you know, get that $20 or $30 that helps them survive on the street. And additional burdens that we place on them seem unnecessary to go after the criminal folks who are engaged in this business. To that degree, requiring that it be issued by check may be a problem. Most of those folks may have some form of ID that does begin to, and this bill requires that they have either an ODL or a government-issued license. Folks who are homeless often are struggling with retaining identification. It appears to require that they have an address. It doesn't specify that it must be their home address. And I know, for instance, when folks are getting IDs who are homeless with DMV, they can use the shelter as an address, because now, as you know, the driver's license must be mailed to them. And so having that flexibility and making sure that the law is not interpreted as requiring that they prove a home residence to give an address would allow, I think, the continued need in this community, in this state, for folks who are struggling and who are not engaged in criminal activity to do the recycling and get the little bit of money they need. And so we'd hope that there'd be some awareness and sensitivity as we relook at this bill and make some tinkering with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Wissett.
Actually, I kind of struggle with this whole section, a lot of the Section 9 from about sub 4 on down. It seems to me that we're requiring the purchaser of scrap metal to determine a lot of things that the purchaser of the scrap metal may not be schooled or even adequately informed to make those decisions. And also, unclear as to why someone 18 years of age or younger should be prohibited from selling scrap metal. Could you comment on that?
Thank you, Chair Posansky. Senator Wissett. I don't know that we've even heard any testimony to suggest that the youth is particularly a suspect class in the theft of the metal. I certainly can't say that I see any reason to compel that it should be a crime to sell to someone, to a minor.
Yeah. And Chair Prozonsky, Senator Woodson, I would add, I think as we see the economy struggling and younger people having problems finding summer jobs, that recycling and other ways to collect some dollars is going to be happening, and why create a restraint on that? I would also point out in that same section that you're struggling with lines 39 or 40, some of the aspects of the 18 years of age and under the influence is based on reasonable suspicion. The next part, whether they have been involved in a crime of drugs, burglary, robbery, possession of stolen property, and a whole list of things, is based on has according to information provided to the business by a peace officer or law enforcement agency been convicted within the past 10 years. I do worry how that's going to be documented and what happens when a business does purchase from someone who has that history and the law enforcement or the government say, we told you, and there's no requirement that be provided to the business in writing so that they have really due notice. And so they are protected against potentially being charged with a misdemeanor for failing to or for purchasing from someone who's been convicted of these crimes. We certainly wouldn't want anyone stopped from engaging in legal business because law enforcement, the government says, hey, let me tell you that person was convicted and providing no information to you as the purchaser to document that. And stopping me from selling to you because of a rumor that I've been convicted of a crime. I think that needs to be carefully documented before there's a crime connected to your receiving it and a prohibition on me selling it.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see. David, why don't you come on up? And Jason, is there anyone else that wants to give testimony? Okay, I'll do one more set after this. Yeah, you can come on up. Gary, if you want to come up, it looks like we have room for four.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jason Huser with the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I want to thank the chair and the members of this committee and numerous other legislators in the building for your engagement on this issue. It's clear you folks are paying attention to getting the details right. We thank you for that. You have written testimony that's coming around, and I know you've heard from some utility representatives yesterday speaking about the on-the-ground challenges for system reliability and public safety in the utility field. I won't go over that territory again. I'll try to till some fresh earth here for you. I did want to say that several utilities in the Southern Willamette Valley have been working as a regional task force along with the Eugene Police Department and other law enforcement agencies on our own regional strategies to deter metal theft. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. I want to say we've sort of envisioned deterring metal theft as a four-legged stool strategy, first leg being law enforcement. That stool was covered very nicely yesterday by our folks from Portland PD. A second leg of the stool, from our perspective, is hardening targets. That is not something that you folks need to tackle legislatively. That is something for, in my case, utilities to tackle. We've been taking some steps in that direction. If you look in my testimony, the second and third pages have two press releases highlighting two strategies that we've employed. For instance, Southern Willamette Utilities got together and came up with a color coding system, and we all decided each utility would paint as much of our infrastructure as possible a certain color. E-Web is green for our ducts down there. It's been a successful strategy. Just recently in Springfield, there was a metal thief who was apprehended, and in the back yard with a shed, they found a bunch of green copper wire. So we have seen some success from that strategy, and it's great for the metal recyclers in the area. They've got this poster in their shop. They know exactly who to call if they see a material come in that has some paint flecks that haven't been removed. Additionally, we're experimenting with barbed wire, innovative lighting strategies. I think some utilities are even hiring private security for drive-bys. I want to caution, though, there are certain centralized infrastructure, such as substations, where we can do a lot to harden a target, but there's a lot of metal related to public infrastructure that is not centralized. It is spread out all throughout the community. Street lighting, highway guardrails, those are items that probably don't lend themselves to hardening targets. But I want you all to know we do accept responsibility for protecting as much metal as we can as an asset, and we're taking steps to do that. The next leg of the stool is some changes to business practices of the metal recyclers. And I do want to highlight an item that we feel is a real important centerpiece in the bill, the commercial accounts. This portion of the bill would create a class of commercial metals and then require that the only folks that can bring those in are folks that have a commercial account set up with a recycler. You'd need to have an Oregon business license and a tax ID number to do that. We think that's a very elegant approach to weeding out certain stolen metals. The class of commercial metals are items that just wouldn't normally be in the possession of your average member of the general public. Things like highway guard railings, cemetery urns, certain gauge of copper wire that are only used by utilities. What we tried to address was, we know that about 95, maybe upwards to even 99% of metal recycling is business to business, and we didn't want to unnecessarily impede that legitimate portion of metal recycling. So this is a very elegant approach that really means business as usual and a lot less red tape, provided that you go to the length of establishing this commercial account. And I do want to make clear the tax ID number, I think, is an important part of that, because an Oregon business license is fairly easy to procure. It could be a loophole that was exploited if you don't accompany that with the requirement for a tax ID number.
On the cash payments, we also think that's the second centerpiece in that third leg of the stool.
I do want to point out, we know there are individuals that may make an honest living bringing in metal. For those folks, for the first week or two under a new law like this, it might be an inconvenience to them, but over time, if they're bringing in metal regularly, they're going to be receiving payment regularly, and we think they can still make a go of that profession. I did want to also address Andrea Meyer's concern about homeless individuals and I think what are called the unbanked Oregonians. I would highly suggest we find a way to consult with advocates for low-income and homeless folks, as well as the credit unions. There may be a way to address that. I know there are credit unions. There's one in Eugene, for example, that specifically caters to trying to bring in the ranks of the unbanked folks that, for various reasons, have avoided getting a checking account set up. I think there's a way, there might be an opportunity to address Andrew Meyer's concern, and I'd be happy to work with you to consult with those groups and see what we can do. I want to talk about the fourth leg of the stool, and I'll conclude there. We know that drug addiction fuels a large percentage of metal theft. Certainly not all metal thieves are drug addicts, but law enforcement has strong reason to believe that that's a big part of the demographic. There's a second side to that coin. Not only does fuel metal theft, but the quick cash from metal theft also fuels drug habits. And I think that the fourth leg of the stool is very important to address. And I know that there's other efforts in the building to deal with drug addiction, and it'd be important to consult with those folks on that leg of the stool. And I'll pause there, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. David?
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. Since you heard...
David, I need you to put your name on the record.
Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland. You heard very able testimony yesterday from our frontline police officers who are working with this issue, so I was not intending to present lengthy testimony, but just to address the questions that the Chair asked before about Portland's electronic reporting system to the best of my ability and get additional information. The Portland currently has a electronic system that it uses for reporting of pawn transactions. It records 120,000 transactions a year. It is being expanded. The City of Eugene is going to be utilizing Portland's system. Portland has said it will make it available to other entities. It is housed in Salem at the Thompson Readiness Center, so it's very secure, fiber optics, and the current state of technology. It has the capabilities of adding metal theft easily to its system, and from what we understand, a number of the metal companies have computer systems that can readily access or modules that can allow it to access that system, and there's also free software to be able to do that. The City of Portland's very interested in being able to have reports of transactions as it does with pawn shops. It finds it to be a very important enforcement and investigative tool in discovering patterns, especially. So the city would very much like the ability to require reporting into its system, particularly in Portland, but if statewide, that would be good too, though it presents other issues for other jurisdictions. But it is an effective tool, and it is something that the city has the ability to make available to others, and I can get more information, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have on that.
All right, thank you. Terry?
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'd just like to put our support on record for Senate Bill 570. We've been involved for over 2 years working with the coalition trying to find solutions to some of the problems. It's a problem that obviously is hitting everywhere, and as I stated in my testimony, and I won't read that, all you have to do is walk out to the Capitol Mall to see that 22 of the 50 bronze plaques on the Walk of Flags have been already stolen. So it hits every sector of Oregon, not just construction or utilities. And to that end, I would just like to reiterate that we have heard some people say, well, what kind of a stake or problem is agriculture or forestry having? And I think you've heard testimony from a number of people that this hits them as well. Matter of fact, it hits any small business that has, you know, copper, aluminum, brass, bronze, or even stainless steel. And I think from that perspective, one of our food processing industry is particularly vulnerable because they have so much stainless steel piping and tankage and equipment. So, you know, we're talking major impacts, not just because the material is stolen and has to be replaced, but oftentimes the corollary damage or the collateral damage, I guess if you were talking in terms of a war, of loss of product, downtime, loss of business, is exponentially larger than the cost of the scrap metal that is stolen. So I would just ask you to continue on your arduous task of finding some middle ground to make this work. And I think the bottom line is that we need to adopt more effective regulations to identify, arrest, convict, and incarcerate the serious offenders. Thank you.
Gary.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, representing CalBag Metals, and I want to reiterate what my principal said yesterday. We are very concerned about metal theft. We've experienced it ourselves. I appreciate that it's different when there's theft in our yard than it is in some of our customers and colleagues' facilities, but nonetheless, we're very sensitive to it, and we view ourselves as partners. Our concern and frustration with the direction broadly of this legislation, the amendments, is that it in many ways criminalizes our business without actually, we think, addressing many of the real problems in terms of deterrent at the point of theft or actually addressing criminal networks, which we believe are really the preferred path for people that steal metal to move it not only out of the community but out of the country to where it's ultimately purchased. My colleague Tom Gallagher, who couldn't be here this morning, has sent all of you, I believe by email, a fairly detailed set of concerns with the bill. What I have provided you today was our attempt not just to say no, but to provide you a proactive way that we can be a partner. It incorporates some of the things that, or it refers to some of the things that you've included, but it puts us in the position of being a partner where we, when we can discover early on thefts, we can be in a position of recognizing those if they show up at our docks, being in a situation of having commercial accounts that we vet ourselves. These are our regular customers who really don't have to be inconvenienced by procedures, but also imposing situations where non-commercial accounts who show up at our docks, they don't have ownership, in fact, can't get cash, and in fact are people who have to essentially go through a little more rigorous process. We're willing to do that. For my client, whose business is one of the larger metal recyclers in the state, actually in the region, 90% of their business is with commercial accounts, people such as Boeing, other people who have large metal that they're choosing to recycle. If we can just separate those from the dock sales and put in place sales even with no cash requirements, we can live with that if, in fact, we're treated as partners in the process. So I offer this up as a way of perhaps reviewing your ideas. We have been participants in the coalition. We support the broad ambitions of the coalition. But, as I said, we have some frustrations with the direction of the bill that's going. We believe that it could be corrected, and we would like to be in a position where we could be supportive along with everybody else here in terms of the direction of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Wessett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. For the metal recycling, things like bronze plaques and multi-strand, heavy gauge, copper wire, highway signs, guardrails, how did those get into the line of commerce generally? I'm assuming that the metal recyclers are unlikely to buy these things. So how do they get in there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if the city of Portland showed up with a truck full of old damaged stop signs, we would probably recognize that as a valid owner. If Joe Sixpack showed up with a couple of stop signs in the back of his pickup, we would be fairly suspicious. We're on the lookout for, our folks are very, very knowledgeable about the kinds of things that are in the metal recycling scheme of commerce, and they're on the lookout. So if we saw somebody that had heavy gauge wire, kind of which PGE would use, we would be suspicious if they were a non-PGE person. And again, our proposal takes that into account. It allows us to be really differentiate who the seller is at our dock.
May I follow up on that?
You may.
that's an interesting discussion, but it really, I don't think, addressed the question adequately. And we know those things are being stolen. And we're assuming that your legitimate businesses are not buying them from those individuals. Yet they continue to be stolen. They must be getting into the line of commerce somehow. Do you have an opinion how that happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, I do. Actually, the example that Mr. Rosenfeld described is the real example, a fairly frequent or recent one. What one of our own employees was stealing from CalBag. The metal was being diverted to a container in a North Portland warehouse that, when full, was going to be transshipped to the Port of Portland, put on a ship, and sent to a destination in Asia where the ultimate buyer was. This is a point I made earlier. There is a criminal network that is known. The people don't come to our docks where we have a big sign. I think you saw Mr. Rosenfeld's testimony that had a picture. They don't show up typically with stop signs in the back of a pickup because they know they're going to be videotaped. They know if they go to our cash place or our cashier's place, what I mean to say, we have an automated system where when you're receiving payment, your picture is taken. Mm-hmm. And these are the tools that we share with Portland Police Department. They were used in the prosecution of our own employee who was suspected, arrested, and ultimately convicted of theft.
One other follow-up, please.
Yes.
How would the, as a professional metal recycler, do you have an opinion on how this black market, in for lack of a better term, metal, and and obviously it's metals that are suspect that you're not going to buy. Do you have an opinion of how to best address that black market? Is there if you don't, that I understand that. But I mean, do you have an idea of how to prevent that black market or to short circuit it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, it's an excellent question. I'm not a law enforcement person, so I don't really have a very good opinion. I think it is our notion that as our industry has put in, particularly in response to 2007, though some of us had this equipment in previous to that, more safeguards at our docks, it has increased the amount of activity looking for another place to go. And there are, given the prices of metal, particularly when those prices are high, there are buyers. A lot of the buyers are in Asia, but they can be anywhere. And people are going to try to find a way to buy that. If they can skip us and skip a middleman, it's even, I guess, more economical for them to do it. But in any case, I apologize my lack of knowledge in the law enforcement area. I don't have an idea of how to go after it, but I would, as I said in my preface to my comments today, it's the kind of thing that I would hope Senate Bill 570 and our coalition would be working on. We should be trying to find those places where this stuff is really going.
I apologize. It was an unfair question to ask you, but you're the only one there, so.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. It's good.
Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up and ask the City of Portland to get back with me or the committee at a later point as a follow-up to Senator Whitsitt's question, and that is what happened in this case where the employee got tagged. The question is you still have a container or somebody rented a facility, which is a large commercial operation, for a container bound to a foreign market somewhere, and what did we do and what courses of action could we have taken? Because I know, and I need to get on record because the utilities made mention of this, under Oregon business law, you're supposed to have a business license to function in the state of Oregon. However, if you don't have a business license to function in the state of Oregon, there is no penalty. Secretary of State does not come after you in a recycling business like this or something. Schnitzer hypothetically would have to sue these foreigners who didn't have a business license and force them to get a business license because we have no teeth in the business law at all. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. And I was passing a note from Jeff Stone, and he just wanted to put on comment The testimony that he handed in, I don't have it right in front of me right this second, but on page 3 and 4, it has some possible solutions for these type of problems. So I'll direct the committee to looking at Mr. Stone's testimony when you review your file as to some other options. My understanding, there is no one else who, let's see, page 3 and 4. There's no one else who wants to give testimony today. Just want to check one more time. If not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 570. And we're going to go ahead and jump into a work session since council's here. Shannon needs to go take care of some other items, and we have another, I think Mr. Taylor's going to be joining us. So I'm going to open up a work session for House Bill 2336, and then we'll come right back and do the testimony on Senate Bill 265. So we'll open up the House Bill work session on House Bill 2336.
Mr. Chair, open.
House Bill 2336, just to refresh your memory, allows for convictions under another jurisdiction's statutory counterpart to be entered into evidence in certain criminal proceedings. It has no expenditure impact and no revenue impact, and we first heard it on March 11th.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question for my clarification. I'm looking at notes from back then, and the question was, I'm assuming we'll define, the state of Oregon will figure out, or somebody will figure out how to define what menacing is under another state's laws. How does that work? Is that the law commission or somebody goes through and comes up, and the Bar Association comes up with a set of parameters? Or
normally how this would work in court is that if a prosecutor wanted to bring in a counterpart or statutory conviction from another state, they would tenor that. And one of the questions I had in the beginning was whether this should be done pretrial or not. And the reality is one of those things that the prosecutor, if they have any question as to what the elements are, but basically the obligation will be on the prosecutor, state or local, to be able to demonstrate to the court's satisfaction that the conviction that they want to use for impeachment purposes actually meets the statutory language of our crime. Okay. So if you have harassment, you look at the elements that Oregon requires to be proven, and then you would have to demonstrate that the elements in the counterpart from Washington State, Idaho, wherever it may be, was similar sufficiently to the point where the court would rule and make a ruling either it is in or it's not.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2336 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Bill Quist moves House Bill 2336 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And anyone want to do? You've got the last one. Senator Wissett will do this one. So Senator Wissett will be our carrier on House Bill 2336. And with that, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 265. And Mr. Taylor is going to substitute with counsel. A substitution of counsel, I love it.
Substitution. How about bail substitute?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 265 comes to you from the Interim Judiciary Committee and allows the presiding judge of a circuit court to establish a mental health court program, and the judge does establish a mental court, requires the judge to appoint a local health court team. We have several witnesses, including Judge Graves from the Marion County Court.
And Judge Graves, if you'll come forward, and Walt, I see that you're signed up on this. That's the only two I see signed up in support. So I'll let you two come up as a panel, and then we'll let others come in after that. And Judge Graves, thank you very much for being here. Apologize for our schedule, but we had that other bill that carried over from yesterday, and I felt obligated to get their testimony in since they had to come back from yesterday.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my privilege to be here and testify individually and not as an official representative of the Judicial Department, because that department has not taken a position on this particular bill. And I've been advised also that given current budget projections, it's possible that the Judicial Department will not be operating drug courts or mental health courts in 2009-11. So I'm speaking on my own as a mental health court judge. And the person to my right, Walt Beglau, was instrumental in establishing the mental health court that we have in Marion County. Essentially, what this bill would do beyond what we have in the current law, I believe, is make the treatment records of participants in mental health court private and exempt from the public records law. That's the situation with drug court participants now in terms of their treatment files. And I think that would be beneficial so that we can have open and frank discussions with our participants and they're not concerned about things that might come back to bother them in the future. I can tell you that with Walt's help as well as former Sheriff Ramirez, that we started a mental health court 27 months ago in Marion County, that we did not have a budget, but we decided if we didn't start it, it wouldn't ever get started. And so a lot like drug courts, the sheriff's office, the health department, the DA's office, and the courts joined together, formed a team after a 24-member stakeholder committee was involved in planning this court over 6 months before we actually began to operate. The team includes a representative from the DA's office, the defense bar, of course, a judge, and we do not have any money for treatment specifically, and so we don't have that treatment arm that's so critical for drug court success present with mental health courts. We only take people who have their own insurance or are being treated under the Oregon Health Plan. And so we have multiple health providers that are working with these participants, and we don't have the ability to have them at the table because it would involve too many of them. So it would be ideal if we had some funds that would pay for treatment. It would help strengthen our court, I think, and allow us to be able to collaborate with the treatment professional. I have some specific information about our court if you have questions about it, but I'll defer to Walt now and let him explain his role to you.
Thank you, Walt.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beklaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We support Senate Bill 265. Mental health courts are a good thing. We've seen that they've, in the courts that have them, laid a foundation for a meaningful, effective, and accountable way to approach those impacted with mental health concerns that are involved in the criminal justice system. And as the judge noted, it has actually been quite a privilege to work alongside and create what we've done in Marion County. And we've seen tremendous opportunities around eliminating repeat offenses, and that's a big boon to the program that we have. We learned the easy way and went to King County and observed what they had put together, and then we've learned the hard way by trial and error over the last 27 months. And just to give you a little the elements of an effective court that we've seen and we've implemented: housing, treatment, and medication. Not only access to medication, but making sure that they're held accountable, that the clients, the defendants that are in our court, participants use their medications as prescribed. So a couple basic things here that that I think would be helpful to understand. It's important that it's tailored to your own county and utilizing local services. We built ours around the individual and not around the offense that was committed. You want to retain, we've learned you want to retain all those tools of accountability at the court's fingertips, and you want to make sure that all the key players are at the table. And I can assure you that a probation officer from your local community corrections is instrumental in making sure, alongside the mental health professionals, the district attorney, the defense bar, consumer advocates, mentors, and of course the court, kind of leading the charge. So from this bill, I don't see any particular concerns. I think it's kind of the policy statement. But I would recommend that from a legislative standpoint, we resist any effort to place limitations on the court or the district attorney. In other words, in terms of team membership, you don't want to mandate any specific kind of sanctioning. You don't want it required to be a diversion program, although ours is generally a diversion program, but there are other cases where we put out their incentives to encourage participants to come into the program. And we've learned that those things are really important. Kind of having that local flavor is a good thing. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And again, I don't see any concerns in this particular bill around those issues that we've looked at over the years.
All right. Thank you. Questions? We're going to start with Senator Bonamici, then Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here and for your testimony. I wondered what the provisions are that allow the disclosure of records. It's at 42 U.S.C. 290. I just wonder what that particular provision is. On the first page of the bill on line 21.
I understand. That, of course, applies, but there's no specific provision that they're protected under the Oregon open meetings records law. And so that provision is in the statute for drug court participants treatment files. And it is not in the statute for mental health court participants files.
Just a follow-up.
You may.
But it appears that that particular provision allows disclosure under certain circumstances, and I just wondered what circumstances they were, if you know.
Court order, potentially. I'm not an expert on that particular statute, and I have attended some seminars about it. I would just be pleased that it becomes a matter of Oregon law that the records are protected under Oregon statute as well as a federal statute.
Oh, thank you, counsel. Okay, thank you. Counsel gave me something that explains that. And just a brief follow-up. I certainly understand the need for confidentiality on some medical records and some sensitive issues, but I was remembering the Oregon constitutional provision about how no court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly. And so I wonder if this intends to put everything confidential, and I wonder how that can happen in light of the Oregon Constitution.
My understanding of the bill would be only in regard to those treatment records, not the proceedings in the court. The court is an open court, that just like other courts are in the state.
Thank you for the clarification.
Sure.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Judge Graves, I certainly agree that drug courts are a good thing. I think mental health courts would be a good thing as well. You alluded to the cash flow problem, and if this bill were to pass, it would seem that it would dilute the available cash flow to the drug courts. So could you discuss a little bit about the relative value of the drug court and the mental health court, the relationship between the two? And would this passing this bill have the net effect of crippling the drug courts by reducing their funding, or would it be complementary?
Certainly, and I'll remind you that I'm speaking as an individual here and not the official position of the Oregon Judicial Department. I don't see the two as being mutually exclusive. I see them as complementing one another. I don't believe there are funding provisions in this particular bill, unless I missed those. And so I think that obviously we have a critical issue with drug addiction in our country, and I think drug courts are meeting that more effectively than any other mechanism of government. In regard to mental health courts, I think we are all aware of the sad situation of mentally ill people being housed in jails. It's very expensive. It's not very effective. And I think mental health courts offer an opportunity to reduce recidivism, especially those people that have repeat offenses, and many of them are relatively minor offenses, and treat those people more humanely and with more kindness and more effectively. I will remind the committee that mental health courts are voluntary, and so the comments that Walt made about medication being mandated, the individual has to agree after consultation with defense counsel that they will abide by the provision that they will take their medication. In regard to funding, as you know, the funding for drug courts has come through the Criminal Justice Commission over the past two biennia, and I think they've done a wonderful job in terms of administering those funds. There is no funding for mental health courts, although there was a bill last session that provided for diversion of mentally ill people from jails. The funding went through the Department of Human Services and then down to the local mental health, local community mental health directors. Marion County's share of that funding was $300,702. The mental health court received none of that money. It was retained by the health department. I can tell you that that pattern is similar, if not identical, in all other counties across the state. I made some efforts in the beginning to approach Bob Nickel about making some of those monies available so that we could pay for treatment in the mental health court, and it was his considered decision that it should go through the local community mental health directors, and that's where the money stayed.
Please, Judge Graves, I would draw your attention to page 4, line 17C through 19, and it basically says for monies for disbursement to drug court programs as described in ORS 3.450 and mental health court programs described in Section 1 of this 2009 Act. So it would appear to be taking some of the funding for the, from the drug courts to facilitate your mental health court.
I was not aware of that. Walt, were you aware of that? Did you read it that way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witt said, I did understand that there was going to be some balancing, that they were placing the mental health court piece on the same level of drug treatment. That was my reading of the bill. My response to your good inquiries are is that these issues are part and parcel. Addiction and mental health issue and co-occurring disorders are in our drug courts, and we see them in our participants in the mental health court. And I'm an advocate for kind of a balanced approach, because we're going to address those issues in our drug court anyway, and we're trying to find the appropriate place. So your point well taken, but I think, in fact, just a good example, within our Marion County Jail, a good percentage, 30-40% have a mental health concern. And so I think the combination of the two is a wise investment, and one of which we can create balance through the funding mechanisms.
Thank you.
All right. I'm just going to do a quick segue on that. Walt, do you know what the numbers are in the Marion County jail as to having dual diagnosis of mental health as well as having alcohol or drug addiction? I know in Lane County, extremely high.
Mr. Chair, it is extremely high in Marion County as well, although I don't have those exact that data at my fingertips today. It is a high percentage within our correctional facility, again, that have a dual diagnosis or some kind of mental health concern that is driving their behaviors and an addiction issue. And again, these are the two top drivers of who's in our jail and criminal behavior. It are mental health concerns and addiction issues across the board.
Thank you. Senator Brockquist.
Mr. just a comment for the record. A couple months from now, as the process starts getting closer to a budget, so on and so forth, I mean, given the judge's comments, that we might want to come as a committee back and look at that, the whole issue of drug courts, mental health courts, because there's a significant cost savings to those entities. And if the if the tone turns out, well, we're going to eliminate them for 2 years, really we're not eliminating them. Those costs are going to be shoved over to the Department of Corrections and elsewhere. It might be something the committee wants to look at a couple months from now.
Right. And I agree with that. And one of the things that we're looking at is this: we want to get this bill up for public hearing. We're not going to be moving it today. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And I know that myself and I believe Chair Barker are going to be meeting with Ways and Means to figure out what our numbers look like, and Senator Wissett will probably be part of that discussion at some levels. You're on the public safety, if I remember correctly.
Yes, sir.
And so I'm not sure when that's going to happen, but all of this is going to have to be bundled and looked at together. So, and then, Counselor, did you want to?
Sure, Mr. Chairman of this committee. Judge Graves, my understanding is that mental health courts, like drug courts, have been evaluated and have been shown to be effective. Is that true? On evidence-based program?
Yes, they have been. There's one study that I'm aware of out of the state of Alaska, and I could provide copies of that study if you'd like. It was based upon two courts in the state of Alaska, and both of the studies reflect that there were significant cost savings for the investment. In terms of the evidence-based practice model, I can't tell you that that's specifically been addressed with the treatment model that's used in mental health courts. Essentially, we're dealing with mental health treatment, and to the extent that certain types of mental health treatment are evidence-based, I couldn't speak to that. I think we really don't know, because we don't have any funding to pay for treatment, the various types of treatment that are being provided to our participants, because we have 26 people in our mental health court, and but for four of them that are being treated, I believe, in the health department, or maybe it's six, they all have separate providers around the city, and they're primarily being paid for by Oregon Health Plan dollars.
Yes. Judge Graves, would it facilitate the process if the mental health money went directly to the courts for drug courts and mental health courts?
Well, in terms of drug courts, the judicial department's position, I believe, is that it should not receive treatment dollars. And here, I'm not speaking officially for the department, but this is my understanding as an individual, that it should not receive treatment dollars or it would have to comply with HIPAA. And so that's why the funding has been outside. In terms of the treatment dollars for people in mental health court, again, I think that same argument would apply in terms of HIPAA's involvement. And if it went through the Criminal Justice Commission, as does our drug court money, I'm confident that we could work well with them.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today. Our last
thank
panel
you.
That I have set to give testimony today is Gail Meyer and Elizabeth Wakefield. Is there anyone else who's going to want to give testimony on Senate Bill 265 after this panel? Ladies?
Members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We also show up in support of the bill. And I've asked to come to the committee today Elizabeth Wakefield. She's the chief attorney. She works for the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office in Multnomah County. She's been there 8 years. She's the chief attorney of the special courts group, which includes the drug treatment, the drug court and the mental health court, community court, and civil commitment court. And she's will truncate our comments, but she's here to testify in support.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. We are here to support this bill. We have worked for many years collaboratively with the Multnomah County bench and the district attorney's office to develop what we have. We are sort of a fledgling court in the Tri-County area. We're a little behind the ball. But we've had a number of very positive experiences. One gentleman in specific has been homeless for the last 5 years, and with the extra support that mental health court was able to provide him, he's now has a home, he's stable with medication, he's stable with a treatment provider. He is going to finally be able to apply for Social Security. He got an ID card for the first time in his life. Seems like small things to most of us, but for somebody who has been in and out of the jail system, taking up jail beds, hospital beds, for many, many years, this is a very significant period of stability. The other area that we in my office have seen that's really made a difference is assisting people coming out of the Oregon State Hospital, transitioning back from jail into the community. It's an area where it's very easy to lose track of somebody. They fall into the community with no support, no structure. They go off their medications, and we're right back where we started with that person back into the hospital. Mental health court and the dollars that have been made available to us in Multnomah County have assisted that transition, and that's been a huge benefit for the clients that we've had. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's going to conclude our public hearing on Senate Bill 265. And as council comes back up here, we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 87. And council, if you can bring us up to speed on the amendments. And we're
Chairman of the committee, we've already adopted the Dash 2 amendments, and I think the amendments that you'll be looking at are the Dash 4. And what they basically do, allow siblings to obtain a copy of the medical report, but they do so differently than the other amendments we saw before, in the sense that they go through the public records exemptions here.
All right, there's a dash three as well.
That's, Mr. Chair. They both do the same thing. They do it differently. I think, at least when I talked to Andrea Myers, who was kind of thought that the dash fours did it better, if I remember correctly, in the sense that you notice up here it's 192.501 that's being amended.
Right.
That's the public records laws. That's a discretionary one unless a public interest requires disclosure. In other words, you don't disclose unless the public interest requires you to do so. And what you have here is records or information relating to a test and autopsy of the medical examiner. Those are non-disclosable unless the public interest states otherwise. And then you have an amendment to the medical examiner statute, and it basically says over here in page 6-9, notwithstanding ORS 192.501, subsection 34, a parent, spouse, or sibling may get a copy of the autopsy report.
All right. So I'm going to ask for a little clarification from the supporters of the bill. And Andrea, if you'll also come up. I guess first question the chair has, is there a preference with the dash fours over the dash threes? Is everyone comfortable with the dash fours?
Mr. Brzozinski, yes. Members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Yes, we prefer the dash fours. I think we've come to agreement. The original bill had to deal with some fixes that ACLU, OCDLA, medical examiner agreed upon a long time ago. Then we had the issue of the autopsy reports and whether or not they are a public record based on a case law. We had the opportunity, I expressed concerns about the approach of removing it from public record entirely. We had easy and good discussions with medical examiners, agreed that it needs to be put in the public record section of the law, and that we would put it in the 501 section, which generally makes these records, autopsy reports, not available to the public except for if there's a high public interest, which is exactly what we had asked for. And so I think we're all in agreement and help urge the committee to move forward adopting the dash four and moving the bill.
And an affirmative from the medical examiner's office.
Senator Brzozinski and members of the committee, for the record, this is Dr. Gunston, the state medical examiner, and we are in agreement with Ms. Myers.
All right. Questions or comments?
Just to clarify, the dash fours relating cause is good. The dash fours won't impact the dash twos, so for the dash two that we already put in, and there is no fiscal, right?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, according to what we received from the LFO as it relates to dash four, there's no fiscal on the amendment or the bill. And I believe it will fit in as relating to death investigation. So this is what the amendment talks about in public records. So
and the four won't impact the two that we already put in?
Twos are in.
Right. I just want to make sure we're not walking on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when you adopt the dash four, assuming you adopt the dash four, we send a memo to legislative council's office saying combine the two and four.
Okay. Second. Are we in work second?
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four into the previously amended SB 87.
Senator Boquist moves the dash four amendments into the amended SB 87 with the dash twos. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 87 as amended with the dash twos and the dash fours to the floor with the two pass.
All right, Senate Bill 87 as amended by the dash twos and the dash fours to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry this one. And council, anything else that we need to take care of today? All right. Everyone, thank you very much for being here. We're scheduled tomorrow, I believe, to start at 8:30. And with that, we're adjourned till then.